We have a special guest in this week's segment of the Libertarian Angle, Jim Bovard. Join Richard Ebeling and me and Jim in a wide-ranging discussion of liberty in America. Hi, I'm Jacob Hornberger, president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, and this is this week's segment of the Libertarian Angle, the show that, as many of you know, brings you the principled case for the libertarian philosophy. And I'm joined, as I am every week, by my co-host, Richard Ebeling, who teaches economics at the Citadel. Richard, good to see you again.
Great to be with you and our special guest.
Yeah, we got a special guest this week, a return engagement, of course. He's been on the show before. Jim Bovard, who's written for the Future of Freedom Foundation for, 26, 27 years or so. Famous author, writer, journalist. Jim, welcome back to the show. Good to have you back.
Jacob, Richard, thanks for having me on. It's funny, I'm just kind of looking at the layout here, and I'm kind of expecting that no one's going to ask me who my interior decorator was.
I don't understand the joke.
Well, it's funny because I'm looking at both you guys, and you've got perfectly organized bookshelves behind you. And, you know, I'm a journalist. What can I say? So, rolling chaos, a rolling chaos lifestyle. And I don't have anybody around. I'll stop right there.
Well, Jim, you've been one of my real life heroes. I got to tell you, for in the battle for liberty, and you've got a fascinating piece today on Mises.org, the Mises Institute site, called Why I Write, that is kind of like autobiographical in nature and brings up a lot of great substantive points. I disagree with your first sentence where you point out that you were born in Iowa and raised in the mountains of Virginia and went to school at Virginia Tech, because I think that detracts from your credibility. I would have left it out. But otherwise, I thought it was a fascinating piece. So I thought, hey, let's start the show by talking about why you wrote this piece, what it's all about, and kind of like where you see we stand in America today.
Thanks very much for your kind words. I understand that you went to VMI instead of Virginia Tech, but, you know, I've always tried not to hold that against you. We can't all be Hokies. Thanks for your kind words on the piece. It was, I was trying to express the reasons and the values that have driven me since I moved to Washington in 1980, trying to explain how I came to see individual liberty as the most important value, and how I my writing is basically mostly been trying to defend that. Sometimes I take some cheap shots on the side, but that's a different story. But how I've tried to help folks recognize how dangerous big government is. And it's also, I was struck when I moved to D.C. to see how low the literary and intellectual standards were, because the basic definition of good writing here is go team go. It tends to be vacuous. It tends to be often as dishonest. If you've got a hard hitting piece exposing a government agency, there's a lot of editors who will say, we don't think so. That hits too hard. And, we're going to a reception later today, and there'll be some people from the agency, and we don't want to upset them too much. So there are so many different influences in Washington that basically curb people telling how it is about how bad government is. And government's a hell of a lot worse than most of the news media admits or reports. Part of it is that a lot of them don't really understand, because for a lot of Washington journalists, reading is the only unnatural act. And the same is true for Washington politicians. There was a survey done a few decades ago to show that the average member of the House of Representatives spent 12 minutes a day reading. And that explains a lot. And these are the folks who are supposed to have oversight and keep a leash on federal agencies. And most of them have difficulty finding the bathrooms in the in congressional office buildings.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there's just this sense of deferential attitude that Washington, the Washington establishment, the mainstream press has. I think it's one of the things that distinguish us libertarians, is that you've got this welfare warfare state. The welfare state's existed since at least the Franklin Roosevelt administration. You've got the national security state that came into existence after World War II. And there's just this embedded deferential attitude toward both of these massive apparatuses. And of course, you can throw in the drug war as part of this whole thing. And you just get the sense that these people never challenge things at a fundamental level because they accept the basic paradigm. So inevitably just turns into a perspective on how should we reform Medicare? How should we reform Social Security? How do we reform the Pentagon? How do we get military spending down by 5%? How do we rein in the CIA a little bit? But nobody talks in terms of that these very well may be the root of much of America's woes. And I think that's one of the things that they find so threatening about people like you and other libertarians is that we come at it by striking at the root. We expose the fallacies. I mean, we're essentially saying the emperor has no clothes. And man, that makes them feel very uncomfortable.
Yeah, thanks. That's something which I've tried to do, striking at the root. Early on, I tried to write about stories or about agencies that I thought should be abolished. I mean, such as the Agriculture Department subsidies. It was interesting looking back at what was the prevailing standard there, because most of the reporters didn't pay attention to it, or the ones who were critical, some of the conservative ones, were saying, oh my, it's terrible to waste the money, so on and so forth. Almost nobody was going into the nuts and bolts of the system and explaining how it worked. This is, to take readers step by step through the absurdities, because once you get past the surface, it looks a whole lot worse. But with the deference, there was a story which I have in there in the piece today about there was a USDA program called marketing orders. And what, based on a 1937 law, what the government does is allow committees of farmers to prohibit other farmers from selling their harvest. These agriculture committees empowered by the government can prohibit farmers from selling up to half their harvest. So back in 1985, I pitched an article to the Washington Post, and the Post editor says, well, it can't be that bad. It can't be that bad. And that was the tacit response I think I've gotten a lot. Most of the time it wasn't verbalized from editors over the last decades. But what was funny on this was basically 20-some years, almost 30 years later, the Supreme Court finally heard a case on these committees, and the liberal justices were shocked. This is the world's most outdated law. I can't believe that the intention was to drive up prices for consumers. And part of the reason the Supreme Court had no idea how bad it was is because places like the Washington Post did not focus on the most outrageous bureaucratic abuses.
Well, Jim, that raises an interesting issue, is that in a country particularly like the United States that heralds the First Amendment to our Constitution with freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, and so on, the press tries to present itself as an intentional muckraker, getting at the truth, holding power to standards, looking for and digging out hypocrisy and corruption, wherever it may be. And yet, as you were pointing out in this autobiographical piece today, you found that you would go to one editor or another editor and another editor. And partly because, as you were saying, they said, oh, it can't really be that bad. We've not heard about this before, so it can't be that bad. An intentionality of not wanting to cover these issues. Now, is it simply that certain news outlets, to use the usual spectrum ideology, lean left or lean right, and therefore, if your guy is in office, you don't want to go after him? Or is it something deeper that has become a problem with the news media in America in general, that they seem to not have this interest anymore, if they ever had it, in just going after lies, deception, corruptions, and power lusting?
Good question. I think it's both of those factors. The media doesn't have much appetite for scandals that don't involve panties or profiteering. Or you got the Donald Trump. Well, I mean, maybe those would fall into those categories. But there isn't much appetite to understand how bad some of these policies is. Maybe it's unfair to criticize editors for not being policy wonks, but one thing I've always tried to do is there was a Roman rhetorician who said that, you know, that something should be written, not that readers might understand, but that readers must understand. And that's the standard I've tried to set for when I write about federal policies, because a lot of these are just so ungodly tangled. The agricultural ones are a good example. There was a standard that the bureaucrats invented in the 1920s, parity. And so for the next 60 years, farmers were whining that that their prices were too low because they weren't 100% of parity. Well, parity was based on a comparison of agriculture prices and industrial prices in the period 1910 to 1914. That was back before we had interstate highways, a lot of good roads, refrigeration, stuff like that. So what in the hell that the prices of 1910 have to do with the fairness of the prices of 1980s? It has nothing, but you had this catechism basically of agriculture policymakers. And it was a complete scam, and yet it was treated respectfully. And there are a lot of similar things driving policy at this time. I mean, if you look at some of the stuff, you know, some of the science and data that's being used to shut down schools for the COVID crisis, I mean, you look past the first numbers and you think, this is it. This is crap.
Well, you wrote this great book many years ago called Lost Rights that is really famous within the libertarian movement. So looking at things today amidst all the pandemic and things, do you think the rights situation has gotten a little bit worse since you wrote that book?
Oh, damn. Hey, I didn't know that there were going to be tough questions in this in this podcast. Damn, you should have warned me. You know, it's interesting. Lost Rights came out in 1994, and thanks for mentioning it. It was a litany of how things were a lot worse than what most Americans realized. I mean, looking back, the 1990s were practically a golden era for liberty, because after 9/11, it's like so many of the leashes of government power were off. You had John Ashcroft out there saying that critics who talked about the phantoms of lost liberties were basically traitors. And it's like, okay, I've been called a traitor before, but when it's the attorney general doing it in Senate testimony, you think like, oh, where is this going to go? But to see what the government has gotten away with after 9/11, it's so much worse than what it did before. I mean, prior to 9/11, the president would not have set up a worldwide torture regime, but that's what George W. Bush did. Secrecy is multiplied. There's probably 10 times more secret documents now than before 9/11. The federal government is classifying more than a trillion pages a year as secret. That's equivalent of 20 million filing cabinets. And there's a lot of democracy and self-government that vanishes in those filing cabinets.
Well, let me sort of, since we're talking about these current events, how do you interpret the way the media has dealt with things like cancel culture or racism generally political correctness of that type? But what are your thoughts given this arrival of this on the scene with such vehemence recently?
Well, you know, going back decades, I've enjoyed hostile comments from federal agents. It's always been a hoot of some secretary of a cabinet department or agency chief like FBI Louis Freeh would write basically a personal attack on an article I did. So I enjoy vigorous criticism and rough and tumble, and I don't expect people to play fair. I mean, there's a lot of cheap shots. I mean, it's politics, so you'd be naive to expect honesty. Flip side is to see the level of stampedes now, to see the folks that are basically enabling these cancel culture mobs, and to see the number of cheap shots that are being done out there. There's so much nonsense going on right now, both by politicians and elsewhere in American society, government agencies, and worse. People need to have a sense that they're, you know, it's wide open to criticize. If you start saying certain things are sacrosanct. If there's a catechism, then, you know, you're probably going to have a lot less truth.
Well, Jim, you've gotten published in mainstream publications for 25, 30 years now, Wall Street Journal, USA Today. You're on the board of advisors or something like that with USA Today. I'm curious as to what your response is now with your types of articles as compared to, let's say, 25 years ago in the mainstream press.
It varies. I mean, there are some editors are open to hard-hitting pieces. A lot of places aren't. Markets open, markets close. Sometimes markets reopen. I think after 9/11, a lot of my criticisms of U.S. foreign policy closed doors to my work, and, you know, that's how it goes. But I'm not going to change my opinions. There are other places that have opened doors. So, it varies on issue to issue and publication to publication.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest benefits of the internet is that it has just really freed us libertarians to just say things exactly as they are, that we don't have to trim our sails in order to please some editor or so forth, and people can access our work this way. And I think there's a power to that, you know, truth, pure truth that we're able to share with people. You've done...
I hope so. I'm not sure. I appreciate, like, on the piece today and why I write, I appreciate Ryan McMakin at Mises welcome that piece, because there were a lot of passages in that piece that would not have flown at a lot of publications. And it was nice that I could write what I think and not have to be polite to the government, to the politicians, or to some of the people that tried to put knives in my back. So,
well, into the press. I mean, you took some jabs at the
press.
Oh,
yeah. Hell yes.
There's no way that anybody in the mainstream press is going to publish that article. I mean, that's the benefit of the internet. Now, you also were one of the leading figures on addressing what happened at Ruby Ridge in Waco. And periodically, you revisit those topics. I mean, those things happened long ago. Why do you feel that they are still relevant to today?
Well, if you look at the standards that were used for Ruby Ridge, for the FBI sniper who shot and killed the mother holding her baby in the cabin door, the same standard has spooked a lot of opposition to the federal agents and federal power. We saw that in the Bundy Ranch standoff in Nevada, 2014 and later. You had an FBI sniper who was sent out there and basically given orders to shoot them if you see them, and he shot the mother, and then the FBI covered it up. The cover-up collapsed. One of the top people involved with that was sent to federal prison. But you had Louis Free, FBI chief, out there saying the FBI did nothing wrong. He said that in response to a Wall Street Journal piece I did. I managed to get hold of a confidential internal Justice Department report that said that basically blew to pieces the whitewash. And I got that out there in another story in the Journal, and that helped put pressure on the feds to settle. But there was a big effort by former attorney generals to assure that FBI sniper had legal immunity. And that was led by Bill Barr, who's our current current president, our current attorney general. I'm not Joe Biden, so I didn't get that one that wrong. But no, and so you have the same legal doctrines, which basically appear to give federal agents a license to kill. And if they have that license, you're going to have a lot more opposition and distrust of federal agents. So it's a good example of how subversive it is for the government to seek to claim absolute power.
Yeah, as an aside, when I was practicing law before I went into the libertarian movement full time, one of my real heroes in the law profession was Gerald Spence. I mean, I was following what Spence was doing. He was heroic, the way he lived his life and defended his clients. And then he ends up defending Randy Weaver on the Ruby Ridge case. And it was just kind of an interesting kind of coming together for me, joining my libertarianism with my interest in the law. I think without Spence, Weaver might not have gotten as far as he did.
Maybe there were some other great lawyers in that in that case, including David Nevin, who handled the case for Kevin Harris, who was accused of shooting and killing a U.S. Marshal. But I think the jury concluded it was in self-defense because the marshal shot first. And if you're not allowed to shoot back at federal agents who are trying to kill you, then, you know, it's hard to reconcile that with being in a free country. But no, Spence had did great work. I saw a printout of his closing arguments to the Weaver jury, 1993, up there in Idaho. Wonderful stuff. I mean, that's something someone should publish as a standalone piece if they haven't already done it on the internet. I had somebody, but back when I was writing about that case, someone contacted me. They lived out in Kansas. They'd seen me quote from the trial. They said, we thought maybe you'd like to have a transcript of the entire trial. I said, yeah, that would be great. They said, yeah, well, $9,000. I said, no. So anyhow.
Richard?
Yeah. Out of all the subjects and issues that you've dealt with, which one or two are you the most proud of, and which one or two you had the most difficulty getting out?
Okay, the dogs are barking. You asked a tough question. The dogs. Okay. The dogs are giving me a chance to. Torture was one of the ones that was most difficult to sell. I mean, I tried to write. Well, from 2004, I wrote a number of stories on torture. They were very, very difficult to sell. It's still a topic that the American media basically takes a powder on. There have been some excellent journalists who have done great work investigating this. There have been some organizations that have done stalwart work, but there's just not much appetite. As far as other issues, you know, Ruby Ridge and Waco. I mean, I was amazed to see when Waco went down that the response of the Washington Press Corps was to confer instant sainthood on Janet Reno, the attorney general, who approved sending in the FBI tanks that collapsed 20% of the building before the fire broke out. And, you know, shortly after that fire, you had Jack Brooks, one of the most powerful members of the House, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, who said that the Branch Davidians, the 80 men, women, and children who were burned to death. Jack Brooks said they despicable people, burning to death was too good for them. This was the attitude in Washington, the people who were respectable. So I did a lot of digging on that, did a lot of writing on that. There were other folks that did great work on FOIA and getting the actual FBI pyrotechnic grenades that they fired at the Davidians' house before the fire started. Oh, we didn't know about those, the FBI said. We forgot to tell people about those. 6 years later, there was another guy, David Hardy, who did great work on FOIA. Hardy found a memo that I think in 1998, 99, you know, it turned out that about a week before the ATF launched their, you know, surprise assault on the Branch Davidians' house, because there was no other way to get David Koresh. It turned out Koresh went target shooting with several ATF agents, and he knew they were ATF undercover agents, and they were out there planking away and talking about government, stuff like that. That, you know, that would never come out until 5 or 6 years after the fiasco. You know, this is a good example of how secrecy makes a mockery of democracy, because that was one of the most high-profile federal fiascos, but it was so much worse than it appeared.
Well, how do you view the situation looking to the future? Because on the one hand, the progressive, or quote, in the American sense, liberal press, just want to push the statist agenda in terms of domestic policies. They're basically placating a lot of issues on civil liberties, such as I mentioned, and you commented about, you know, counterculture and stuff. And then you have the conservatives, particularly because with Trump in the White House, you know, anything that is not liked by them is suddenly fake news. Where does this leave us looking to the future?
Drink heavily, buy more ammo and drink heavily. It's ugly. And it's interesting. It were 5, 6 years ago, there was comment about how the libertarian moment had arrived. Well, if it did, it didn't stick around. The political situation is bad because we're basically, almost guaranteed to have a bad president for at least another 4 years. Trump has abused power in so many ways. Biden, I think Biden would be a disaster as well. There is not much evidence that people have learned the dangers of federal power. There are a handful of excellent people on Capitol Hill, but you know, you can put them in a small van. So I don't know. I was trying to end that essay today on optimistic, on an upswing about, we'll keep fighting, and you know, it's not possible. Politicians can never outlaw the spirit of liberty, which is true, but short term, I've been shocked to see how easily politicians can shut down everything with this pandemic based on data and science, which their data is often crap and their science is often a bunch of absurd extrapolations. And they've simply ignored all the lives that they've damaged. I did a piece last week on the school shutdowns, and I was looking at the numbers. There's some very good reports on the adverse impact on Black and Hispanic kids and low-income households in general. I mean, it's been a complete disaster for them. It's different for the middle and upper income families, where the parents are there to do the, do the tiger mom routine on kids reading. But this is a complete disaster for education. And the politicians are claiming that if there's any cases out there that they need to have absolute power to shut things down. There was a health czar here in Montgomery County, Maryland, who said he was entitled to shut down private schools if there were more than 8 new COVID cases per day in this county. And this county's got 1 million people. And so that means that he has dictatorial power if there's 0.000008% COVID cases. I mean, it makes no sense, because you're doing so much destruction, and the media has not been honest on this. It's almost like the flip side of how the media has covered up a lot of the damage from the rioting and looting earlier this summer or yesterday in Chicago. Either one.
All right. Well, that raises the title of your essay that we've been talking about, Why I Write. I mean, clearly, you know, we've been in this, FF's been here for 30 years, and clearly liberty has gotten worse. I mean, the plight under which we live, under the welfare warfare state, has gotten worse. We're
endangered species.
Yeah, well, then
endangered species. So
then why continue writing? You see, why should people continue supporting the libertarian movement? Why should there still be libertarians? Why should we continue to be fighting? And my perspective is, well, you do it because it's right. Yeah, and speaking the truth is there's some gratification to that, and you must experience that a lot, because you're over here exposing all the faults and foibles of these welfare warfare state programs. But I'm still one of those that says that you can never know for sure the trajectory of a country. As bad as things are, the direction the country is going, things can turn on a dime, and that is, of course, raises the power of ideas and ideas on liberty, principles and ideals, that all of a sudden they can grab hold within a society, sweep across the society like wildfire, and catch everybody off guard. So what's your take on it?
People ask me why I keep writing. You know, it's part of the terms of my parole. So, there was a paragraph, you know, I was trying to end that essay on an upbeat note, and there was a paragraph, next to the last paragraph I dropped. And it was talking about the Parthian archers back in the ancient Roman Empire. The Parthian archers were famous because they would be appearing to fall back in full retreat, and then they would turn with their arrows and have a devastating shot. And people who are fighting for freedom right now, they're a little bit in the situation of Parthian archers, because we are losing ground, we are being driven back, but it's also possible to take those shots at Leviathan, to expose the government atrocities at their worst, and all of a sudden that can stop the progress. I mean, at this point, it's sort of a holding game where you're just trying to minimize losses for the time being, and hopefully that hopefully there'll be a time where people care more about this. I had a line in there quoting Edmund Burke, that people never give up their freedoms except under some delusion. And it's the media who's making some of those delusions. But after writing about these things for a lot of years, I also wonder how many Americans give a damn about freedom.
Yeah, well, how many Americans realize they're not free? I mean, I think that's part, that's the initial problem, is that ever since Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, saved free enterprise with his welfare state and regulatory state, people have been convinced that they live in a free society. And my favorite quote of all is the one by Goethe that says, "None are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free." And I think we overcome that challenge, we've got ourselves a chance of winning this battle.
Well, I don't know about winning the battle, but if we can just prolong the struggle, I mean, short term, that may be the best. You know, you're just kind of holding out. So, which is what a lot of people pushing for freedom are doing now. And there's a lot of people doing great work for freedom. Future Freedom Foundation is there in the front line. There are a lot of activists around the country, a lot of other fine writers, and some excellent publications. But it doesn't look promising. And to see how easily politicians could shut down the churches, for instance, this year. I mean, you know, the politicians say it's okay to have the mass protests against the police killings, but, you know, we got to keep the churches shut down. It's like, why would people tolerate this bullshit?
Well, you know, if I can just sort of try to have a glimmer of more, you know, less despair.
Good.
The last 100 years, and I've written about this a few times, the last 100 years has often seemed to be the twilight of liberty. Imagine if you were living back in the 1930s as a classical liberal or libertarian. You know, there's Hitler in Germany, Stalin in Russia, Mussolini in Italy, democratic socialists and labor parties in other parts of Europe. There's the New Deal in the United States. You've got to believe that collectivism in most likely some type of totally planned and totalitarian form is the wave of the future. Well, it didn't turn out that way. The Nazis and the fascists ended in World War II. Then there was the thing as well, you know, the communist threat. The example I often use is that there was this very excellent conservative French social critic named Jean-François Revel.
Yes, wonderful writer.
About 1985, 86, a book that he had written maybe a year or two earlier appeared in English called How Democracies Perish. And his premise was, you know, the communists know what they want. They're dedicated. They have a vision. We in the West, we've become decadent. We no longer even understand, let alone want to defend freedom. And he doesn't end the book by saying, you know, it's the end of the world. The commies win. But that's clearly the sentiment as you close the volume. Well, 1985, 1986, it's the Soviet Union that was gone in 5 years later. And now there are these concerns that you know, well, you know, these trends, these waves are insurmountable, quote, inevitability. Well, they don't have to be. Sometimes you're just lucky because of the circumstances of unintended consequences. But the other time is, if there's enough people who speak out for liberty and defend the importance of the dignity and autonomy of the individual and do muckraking the way you do, Jim.
All right.
To show that the state god is on a pedestal, but he's really built of clay. If enough of that is done, it does not mean that the future is in their hands. It could end the 21st century as a century moving towards liberty rather than tyranny.
I agree, and that's a great point about the 1930s. I mean, things the human race bounced back from a hell of a lot worse situation that is in right now. I mean, one flip point on that is that there were a lot more people that understood freedom in the 1930s than there are nowadays. And I think there was more of a spirit of tolerance then. Maybe not. But I mean, I absolutely don't want people to be fatalist on this, because I've seen a lot of cases, some of the things I've written about, where all of a sudden the government is forced to admit that it killed someone wrongfully, or that a seizure of power was unconstitutional. So it is possible to make progress. And it is possible that more people will wake up at some point. I thought it would have happened sooner, but I've been wrong before.
Yeah, well, the way I look at it is, if you go back to the late 1800s, for example, and I have to be real careful here because my critics always are ready to pounce whenever
The lynch mob is there in the background. All right, he mentioned the 1800s. Go for him.
Oh, exactly. Oh, well, is he going to condemn slavery? Okay, I condemn slavery. But, I mean, when you look at you had a society with no income tax, no IRS, no Federal Reserve, no drug laws, no immigration controls, no economic regulations to speak of, no minimum wage laws. I mean, this was a very, very unusual society. Now, there were some negatives. There's no question about it. But if you were a socialist in the late 1800s, you had to have been there saying, how are we ever going to convince people to adopt an income tax, a central bank, a Federal Reserve, a welfare state? I mean, you had to have been filled with despair. And yet, within a relatively short period of time, the socialists had accomplished what they wanted under the rubric of saving free enterprise. Well, to me, if you could shift things that way, you can certainly shift them back the other direction, especially now since we've had so many decades of experience under this way of life. I think people are starting to figure out that something is fundamentally wrong with America. They just haven't figured out what it is yet. But I think if they start figuring out that we libertarians have the diagnosis right and the prescription right, I think things can shift in the positive direction, just like they shifted in the negative direction.
It's certainly possible, and I'd be happy to see it. And I'll keep writing and trying to expose these outrages. And I'm glad that both y'all are out there in the firing line as well. Things could get better.
Well, so let me just ask you the final question here before we wrap up. If we do achieve the free society, what are you going to do for a living?
I'll see if I can get work as a cigar tester.
All right. On that eloquent note, we'll wrap things up. So if you're new to the Future of Freedom Foundation, come and visit us at fff.org. We've got Jim's articles every month. He writes for our monthly journal, Future of Freedom. We also regularly link to his articles in our FFF Daily, which we invite you to subscribe to. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. This is our mid-year fundraising drive. We could sure use your generous financial support. Thank you all that are sending in your donations. We're very appreciative. And Jim, it was great to have you back on. And Richard, as every week, has enjoyed the conversation.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate that.
It's great having you on, Jim. I hope you'll join us again in the near future.
Thanks. All right. And we'll see you all next week for another segment of Libertarian Angle.